That was the Eclogue for Piano and Strings by Gerald Finzi, played by the pianist Peter Donohoe, with Howard Griffiths conducting the Northern Sinfonia. Plenty of English music in tomorrow's first visit to the BBC Proms. Granville, Bantock, Elgar, Arnold, Walton and Coates, all played by the BBC Concert Orchestra, and the first prom to appear on BBC Radio 2 as well. That's here on the home of the BBC Proms, Radio 3, 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Earlier in the day, we'll be paying another visit to the Cheltenham Festival in our lunchtime concert. Tomorrow, a combination of chamber music and song. The Spanish mezzo Claudio Moriz and the pianist Joseph Middleton team up, as they have done several times during her tenure on the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme this year. They'll be performing music by Ravel. And then the Signum Quartet plays the second of Benjamin Britten's string quartets. That's at 1 o'clock tomorrow lunchtime in our lunchtime concert here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, hello there, lovely listener. D-Love here again, back to share the love for digital radio on BBC Radio 3. Tell me, can you think of anything better than listening to your favorite music on the radio? I can. Listening to your favorite music online in glorious HD sound. That's right. You could listen to the Proms online, giving your favorite music the HD treatment it deserves. Do the right thing. Share the love.
If you love radio, go digital. To listen to the Proms live in HD sound, visit the BBC Radio 3 website and click on Listen Live.
Always nice to hear from the controller of Radio 3. It's now just after 10:15. Time for us to go back to the Proms, in fact, and a Proms Plus late event of music and poetry that was recorded last week at the Royal Albert Hall. Here's Georgia Mann to introduce it.
Hello and welcome to this evening's Proms Plus Late, where we are settling back for some post-prom poetry and music upstairs in the Elgar Room at the Albert Hall as the night draws in behind these wonderful arched windows. And our band this evening actually formed about 3 years ago, just across the road from where we are now at the Royal College of Music. Tir Eolus are a folk band who have really drawn on traditions around the world to forge a very distinctive sound, which we'll be hearing plenty of, and we'll be hearing them giving us traditional music as well as their own music, and plenty of it too. And our poet tonight is Richard O'Brien, who I must say describes himself as a decreasingly young poet, performer and dilettante. And I'm not going to attempt a better introduction than that, but I can tell you that he won the Foyle Young Poets of the Year award twice. He was part of the South Bank Centre's record-breaking Poetry Parnassus, which was a huge festival of the spoken word. And when he's not involved in poetic exploits, he blogs for the Huffington Post and is currently in the throes. Well, in fact, he's actually just finished his first novel. And we'll be hearing from Richard very soon. But before that, it's Pip Mercer, Rory Glasheen, Laura Snowden and George Harris. And this is Tir Eolus.
To me. plea to future philanthropists. Dear sir/madam, permit me to dispense with the delicate dance, the stately sidle up to the tablature of talent, bills, and rent, the awkward pseudo-bridal courtship of the court short and the idle, and in its place submit a simple plea, a free-from-frills request. Invest in me. But first, a test. Let's get our money's worth. I'd like a full account of who you are. A tender-hearted thug, salt of the earth or landed, underhanded, oiled from cars, a quaffer of champagne or caviar. There are some caveats one ought to factor in when getting into bed with benefactors. What, exactly, are we all together in? If one of us has to be patronised, and it's the turn of capital to captain, then it's prudent to ensure we won't capsize. Do any of the following apply? Consorting with consortiums, ex-cons, funding hedges I can't prick my finger on, or money sunning in some beach retreat, technical virgin undeclared in Kent. With so much hanging in the balance sheet, there is an ocean between broke and bent. So when all's said and spent, if you can outsource creativity to your accountant, then you don't need me. You don't need me. I'm ornament, gold leaf, no more essential than a mounted moose, a taxidermist you can tax relief, gift aid against a gift with no clear use. What have you got to lose? Preserve me. For a reasonable price, I'll preserve you. I'll bring my own supplies if you've a spare wing you could take me under. My jotting pad, a pack of Bics, my wits. Keep me in tea. I'll try to show you wonders beyond any public-private partnership. And by the muse of calculated risk, if you stand back, resist the urge to edit, I'll do my best to bring us both some credit.
Richard O'Brien, more from him anon. Pip, hello.
Hi.
Just a quick word. Now, first of all, Tyrolus, yep. Gorgeous sounding name, it's quite poetic in itself. Where does it come from? What is this thing, Tyrolus?
Well, it's Gaelic, and it was Rory's great idea to come up with this name for the band, and it actually means sort of land, like information about the land, land information.
Land information sounds yeah. slightly bureaucratic. Yeah. You can maybe imagine a council has a file labelled this, but not obviously in Irish. So as we said before, you met across the road, Royal College of Music.
Yep.
Did you get a happy twinge, a warm feeling coming here tonight, just across the road where you all met?
Yeah, very much so. It's really nice to be back, and we rehearse in college still, so it's always a nice feeling of sort of coming home.
So you're still very much connected.
Yep.
So we're going to be hearing your own music, as I've said earlier, but I just wondered, when you're choosing the traditional songs, the one that we heard you sing before, She Walks Through the Fair, I mean, when you approach those, what makes you think that's a Tyrolus song? We can really do something with that. We can really get our teeth into it. What's the criteria that you look for?
I'm not sure there's necessarily a set criteria. I think it's mainly about what we each love, because part of why we chose the name was because we're all from different places and we all know folk music from around the world. And we're trying to sort of merge that all together. So it's not necessarily like a criteria, but what we love. And then we try it and see what ideas we all bring to a new arrangement together and try and hopefully come up with something new and exciting.
It certainly is. And you're going to be doing us next a piece composed by Laura.
Yep.
And this is Ida.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what we're about to hear.
Well, Ida was written by Laura after reading a book.
Yes, a book called No Roof in Bosnia.
That's
which is about a group of refugees who are escaping a civil war, and they come across a lady in a deserted village who hides them and saves their lives.
Great story. Guys, take it away. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. 40 days and 40 fears and nights for the rights of man. Did she rid me of my tongue, cast me out of sight, and play the foolish female? Hiding was I, when the men they blustered in gin. She had them drink, using only when they turned to mumbling drunkards. Tell me, lady, why laid me low with no reason? Seasons and seas apart, lady, to you I owe my freedom. Dirty songs, dirty they would sing, humiliated her, unworthy to come close. In the hall would ring her false, hysteric laughter. In the morning, like God's sight, did I of her dirt on her wall, painted its spite and a stench of stale whiskey. Tell me, lady, why laid me low with no reason? Seasons and seas apart.
This poem that I'm going to read now was inspired by an episode of Radiolab, which is an American kind of pop science podcast. And they're talking about the idea of colour and how human beings generally have three cones in their eyes for the perception of colour. I'm not a scientist, but I'm fairly sure that that's within the bounds of my knowledge. They have cones to detect red, blue, and green, essentially. And they were speculating about what it might be like if a person had a fourth cone in their eyes. What kind of colours would they see, and how would they be able to even describe them to people who didn't have that capacity? And this poem came out of that. So I was telling a friend about it, and he suggests I call it Cone-Eyed Girl, which would have been funny, but also illogical, because everyone has cones. This person just has more cones. So the name for someone who has four cones in their eyes, if they existed, would be a tetrachromad. So this is a poem about someone who sees things in a different light, and it's called Four-Coned Ruth. Ruth was a tetrachromad in a small town by the sea, which meant she saw a colour more than her neighbour's eyes could see, or rather, more than a colour more than the common red, blue, green. She saw the shades those mixtures made and the secret shades between. So red for Ruth had a glint of green, green was a grade of red, and yellow grew from the bluest blue like flowers from the dead. If in every lie lay an anagram which assembled spelt the truth, that was the way the world conveyed its light to four-coned Ruth. But Ruth kept quiet mostly in that small town by the sea. One didn't boast about the almost extrasensory. See, what was known was what was felt, and what was seen made sense, and sense was shared. People were scared of Ruth. She made them tense. By implication, all their lives they'd seen the rainbow wrong. Or not enough. If her cones were buds on wagging small town tongues, water would taste like sparkling wine, sweet wine like dry vermouth. You would be thirsty, fit to burst, if you were four-coned Ruth. Let's say she took a lover, Ruth, in that small town by the sea. And for argument's sake, and to up the stakes, let's say that it was me. And suppose her skin was as sensitive as her irises to light, then twice as much. Dark doubles touch. We only met at night. Then imagine a feeling next to which the time's all tension spilled to a shiver so pure it verged on air would seem like a dentist's drill to a patient without anesthesia turned in a rotten tooth. Let's say my body felt that way in the arms of four-coned Ruth. Or so she'd tell me when we met in that small town by the sea, where the sky would spit and us within it, iridescently. But Ruth grew tired, eventually, of the limits of my view. I guess we saw things differently, as lovers sometimes do. And lasers can't correct all defects. Trust me, friends, I've tried. Or even most. But come close. Closer. Look into my eyes. If you believe, for confirmation. If you don't, for proof. You'd see what's hid beneath these lids if you were four-coned Ruth.
Thank you.
The title of this poem is The Smell of Apples, and it has an epigraph which explains it a bit. It's from the book of Sir John Mandeville, which is a wholly spurious work of medieval travel literature. It's a kind of 14th century trip advisor. If you wanted advice on a trip that you could never take because the place it is going to doesn't exist and none of the people it talks about ever existed either because they're biologically impossible. This is The Smell of Apples. Oh, give me the thread from the hem of your dress that you caught in St. James's Park, and give me the blank in the blink of your eyes before they adjust to the dark, and give me the space in the skin of your throat that you smooth away with a breath, and the infinitesimal decimal points between your tongue and your teeth. Then give me the drip of a droplet of water that found its way down through your hair, and give me the light that your body divided and spread like a sodium flare. Now give me the dust that you brushed from your jeans in the chairs in the station cafe, and give me the spark that was spat from the track of the train that took you away, and give me the dot on the eye in the map of the village where you live, the cross of the T in a neighboring town, if it's all you've got to give. And then give me a signal, a cipher, a sign, a trinket, a token, a ring, and I'll follow it blind to the base of your spine, and I'll give you everything. Thanks.
Rory Glasheen, I'm going to ask you to show me your bairon now. What's a bairon?
A bairon is a traditional Irish frame drum, and it probably originally came from Africa. Nobody really knows. And the skin is made out of a goat, not living goat, a dead goat.
Are you sure?
And it's quite modest, and it's just a little wooden frame. And then you have a little stick called a tipper, which you beat it with.
And when did the bairon first come to pass for you?
I was very young. I was about four, and then I played until I was about four and a half, and then I stopped until I was about 18.
And then you just couldn't keep away.
Yeah,
back
indeed.
To the bairon. So tell us what you're going to be playing for us next.
So this is a traditional Irish song called She'd a Woman Away, which translates to something like the wealthy widow, and it's about a wealthy widow. It's from the west of Ireland, and it's usually sung unaccompanied, but we got into the spirit of it, and we all got involved, a bit of the action. So this is She'd a Woman Away.
She'd a woman more, she'd a woman more, she'd a woman more, she'd kind of Connecticut. She'd a woman more, she'd won this morning. Got a nickel, she'd rock a shadow. Bessa can shim, cause you don't need a nut, or he not him, but you don't look at me. Kahi she shun, you know, not a cool need, or he she shun, she got like an attic. Oh, she the one more, she the one more, she the one more, she got like an attic. She the one more, she won this water. Got a nika, she had a rock, a shadow. Mustn't do votes, Scotty Gavoski, 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 Scotty
one more, she the one more, she the one more, she got a Connecticut. She the one more, she well is water. She had a while, she had to go. Mass and Duvosa, Carla Connecticut. Toss him the Vosa, toss him the Vosa, Shashem is smart, I guess, my Danny Cassie. Hey, she the one more, she the one more, she the one more, she Carla Connecticut. She the one more, she won this water. I got a Nika, she had a rock, a shadow. She the one more, she the one more, she the one more, she Carla Connecticut. She the one more, she won this water.
Music by Tia Ulas and poetry by Patrick O'Brien, introduced by Georgia Mann. Well, our next Late Proms Plus event is on Radio 3 next Wednesday, but we're recording it this Friday in the Elgar Room at the Royal Albert Hall. The Sam Watts Quintet and the poet Amy Blackburn more perform. You could be in the audience. You don't have to have gone to the prom that night, which finishes at about 10:30 that evening, by the way. So if you are there, stay on for the Proms Late Plus event, or pop along if you're in the area. 10:45, Friday night, for late night music in the Elgar Room.
Maybe I'm naive, but I think this music almost doesn't need any pre-concert talk. Just be open to the music, just open your mind and open your heart and enjoy this greatest piece.
On Radio 3, pianist Nikolai Lugansky plays Rachmaninoff at the BBC Proms. Join me, Clemency Burton-Hill, on Friday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. Now, last year we marked the bicentenary of Edward Lear's birth with a series of essays, considering the exuberant play of Edward Lear as a nonsense poet and artist, and the influence of nonsense on modern life. Well, over the coming fortnight, we're repeating this series, and this evening, the writer and academic Sarah Lodge considers Edward Lear as a tragicomic writer.
When we say, oh, it doesn't matter, it is usually because it does. One of the ways in which we disguise impossible desire from ourselves and others is to keep it light, to play it for laughs. We don't mean it. It is therefore in nonsense, in that kind of play that we declare doesn't mean anything, that we often find our deepest desires, half hidden, like a door we have painted shut but still want to walk through. Edward Lear's nonsense is full of this kind of submerged longing, the desire for something to be open that should be closed, a beard that is full of birds, a hat that is a nest, a moonbeam that lifts you up like an elephant's trunk to show you whatever you wish to see. As a child, I was mesmerised by the chorus of the Jumblies. Far and few are the lands where the Jumblies live. Their heads are green and their hands are blue, and they went to sea in a sieve. The Jumblies is a delightful poem because it is the opposite of a cautionary tale. The Jumblies set off in their sieve, whose fatal openness should sink them. And everyone says, who saw them go, oh, won't they be soon upset, you know, for the sky is dark and the voyage is long, and happen what may, it's extremely wrong in a sieve to sail so fast. The Jumblies ought to be upset. They ought to come to grief, but they don't. They come instead to a land of happiness, where they buy a hive of silvery bees and a lovely monkey with lollipop paws. And when they sail back home, the naysayers are converted. Everyone said, if we only live, we too will go to sea in a sieve. The Jumblies is a wishful poem, a poem of happy, wishful thinking. But it is also a wistful poem, a poem that looks intently, yearningly at something distant and elusive. Far and few sounds a little like Xanadu, the lost land where Kublai Khan decreed his pleasure dome. Even as a child, I think I understood that The Jumblies was a poem about happiness that was tinged with sadness, and that poignancy is part of its pleasure. Why are Lear's poems and paintings always tinted with ineffable blues, the far horizon that we fix our eyes on? One of the reasons is personal. Like Charles Dickens, who was born in the same year, Lear carried an unspeakable grief from childhood that was also a grievance. Both of his parents had, in different ways, failed to provide for him. Lear was the 20th of 21 children. His mother, like the old woman who lived in the shoe and had so many children she didn't know what to do, couldn't or wouldn't care for him. He was largely brought up by his eldest sister, Anne. She became a surrogate mother to this exuberant, depressive, affectionate child who suffered from epilepsy, an affliction he learned to control but couldn't admit even to close friends. Like Dickens, Lear grew up respectably middle class, but retained a searing memory of having narrowly skirted the abyss of complete financial and emotional ruin. His father was a sugar refiner turned stockbroker who lost his shirt on the stock exchange when Lear was four and was imprisoned for debt. The family finances never recovered. Lear sometimes complained, with mild exaggeration, that he had been thrown out into the world without a farthing to work as a jobbing artist when he was 15. He never settled in one place, had a secure income, or a permanent partner. Lear's writing is a fantasy of social companionship that deliberately evades the rules and vicissitudes of the parent-child relationship. But the longing for escape, for the distant and wondrous in Lear's poetry, is also a feature of the time and culture in which he grew up. In a notebook, which he was keeping in 1829 when he was 17, Lear copied out lines about the sea by James Bird, a working-class poet. "Thou trackless, dark and fathomless and wide, eternal world of waters, ceaseless tide of power magnificent, unmeasured space, where storms and tempest claim their dwelling place, thy depths are limitless." In the 1820s, the sublime, with its ability to inspire awe and communicate power, was a key romantic subject. Turner was painting his landscapes and seascapes, in which the elemental beauty of light, of water, of distance, were conveyed in brilliant washes of colour that faded into shimmering evanescence. In his notebook, Lear was also writing poetry that tried to capture the beauty of the vanishing point. One poem describes the ruined Temple of Jupiter, now known as the Temple of Fire, on the Greek island of Aegina. This was a subject that Turner had painted in 1816. Turner's paintings, which featured dancers revelling in front of the temple, are a coded message in support of Greek freedom from Turkish oppression. Lear's poem is similarly a piece of youthful political dramatisation. "Greece was like thee sublime," Lear writes of the temple. "But Greece has fallen like thee, desolate, wildly lone, her sons the brave and free, forgotten and unknown. The echo of her fountains seems her lost children's sigh, and on her loveliest mountains sits dark captivity." Lear's lament for the ruins of Greece echoes Byron, who had died fighting for Greek independence in 1824, and whose death had left Lear stupefied and crying. This poem shows the young Lear as a romantic poet. Lear is caught up in the sublimity of loss, the fall of civilizations, the battle for liberty. If you look at the notebook in which this poem is written, however, there is something unintentionally comic about it. Lear's drawing of the Temple of Jupiter would fit comfortably onto a postage stamp. And the notebook is also full of fancy sketches of birds, a goldfinch, a woodpecker, which are so tiny and precise that far from being wild, they seem to belong on a teacup. The contrast between the vastness of the sublime and the littleness of Lear's sketches is funny and touching. And this tragicomic relationship between big and little, the transcendent and the domestic, is, I think, at the heart of Lear's nonsense. Lear's nonsense narratives are romantic in essence. They involve a quest for liberty, a longing for the unobtainable, a delight in the unfettered play of nature. The moon and the sea are the divinities under which Lear's poetry dances. The pull and sway of his verse rhythms are those of unconscious attraction, of our night side and its dreamy, illogical but compelling journeys. Yet Lear's poetry incorporates both the romantic longing and the knowledge of its own absurdity. It sends up its own pretension to be poetic. That is the secret of its rawness, its comic vulnerability. In Lear's writing, the sublime is ridiculous. Two old bachelors, looking for food, climb a hill and meet a sage, a wise old man reading an awful book with a perplexing page. They try to chop up the sage and make him into a sage and onion stuffing for the mouse they plan to eat for dinner. But he refuses to offer the content they seek, bashing them with his big book all the way home. They are forced to abandon their quest in despair, an emotional state that Lear in letters comically renders dish-pair. However, and this is the magic of his poetry, the ridiculous in Lear is also sublime. In The Dong with a Luminous Nose, the dong wanders, lonely and wild, looking for his lost love on the great Grombulian plain, where the angry breakers roar as they beat on the rocky shore. This is what Lear elsewhere calls the silent roaring ocean, a tide of internal contradiction that conjures real anger and real pain. The dong transforms his desire into an absurd, enormous appendage, a nose that lights up the dark as he pursues the romance of the infinite. He is a ludicrous figure, but the smile we bestow on him acknowledges that in the matter of desire, we are all impossible creatures, always just following our noses. There is something defiant, as well as deeply humane, about Lear's nonsense. The boundaries between humans and animals, which are created and reinforced by words, prove to be arbitrary and easily overcome. Victorian critics were more appreciative than we are of the way in which his nonsense verses break the rules. A reviewer in The Spectator of 1870 noticed that the duck which hops from its nasty pond onto the tail of the kangaroo has an air of passionate plebeian yearning, while the kangaroo is aristocratic. Here is an allegory of class mobility. The same critic noticed that it is the female pussycat, in the true spirit of women's rights, who asks the male owl to marry her. Nowadays, we tend to miss the romantic whisper of liberty in Lear. George Orwell was rather impatient with Lear's whimsy. He felt that nonsense was at its best when, like Kafka's surreal vision, it was opposing the tyranny, the twisted logic of an oppressive political state. What Orwell failed to see is that the repressive state to which Lear's poetry responds lies chiefly within us. We are taught that to become adult is to cease to think like a child, to abandon the immoderate wish and ridiculous behaviour, to cease to be open to pleasure as our chief navigational aid. Words become the tokens of our admission to a shared rule of expression in which certain things, nouns, and ways of describing them, adjectives, are collectively acknowledged to exist, and all others lie outwith the realm of rational discourse. But we all know, deep down, that the system is itself twaddle. Adulthood is a polite fiction. Most of our inner life takes place between its lines. Most of Edward Lear's nonsense was written as a gift for friends' children. It remains a powerful gift for our child selves, a way of acknowledging a loss we cannot otherwise easily confess. When the Jumblies sail home, everyone says, "How tall you've grown," which suggests that Jumblies are like children, very small people who, against